Not sure I can live up to that introduction. That was moving. Hi, everybody. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Happy to be here. I want to thank the readers and thank everybody for having us up here. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985, and for that I am eternally grateful. Thank you. Believe me, that's the power of you guys and the power in this room you're applauding. I've seen what the power of Charlie Parker will get done. I want to thank anybody that had anything to do with putting this thing on, you know, Zan and Harlan and all the committee members. If you've ever been involved in something like this, you know there's a lot of people that work really hard to get something like this to come together. And if you're like the group I come from, there's also a lot of people that didn't do a darn thing. But we have a lot of ideas about how it could have been just a little bit better. You know, I mean, so that's the fellowship I crave right there. I want to thank Jake for picking us up at the airport, and Zam, we had a good time with them. And then Lowell, it's special. I got a lot of friends in this room. There's a lot of people we've come to know over the, but then Lowell and I have been working together for a couple of years, and I told him I was really hoping he'd come further by now, but he said if I'd have been a more active sponsor, he might have, but we're having a good time here. There's a lot of good folks here, and my God, the speaker lineup, I know, you know, Eileen did a great job this morning, and the lineup. I mean, you've got me now. If you're thinking of taking a nap during the Al-Anon speaker, not that that ever happens, don't do it. I'm telling you, Patty will make you wet your pants. You got a lot of Texas contingent here, you know. I mean, there's there's Katie and I and then Patty here, you know. And, I mean, not that there's a lack of humility in Texas, but my dad always said you should never ask somebody where they're from, because if they're from Texas, they'll tell you. And if they're not, you shouldn't embarrass them, you know. So it'll get worse, believe me. But then Rich and Lauren and I, you know, and we have become good friends. We were just together in Puerto Vallarta, don't miss the Sunday morning talk. And then Matthew is one of our favorites, and then Father Tom, we just met him in Cedar Rapids a few weeks ago. It's a lineup. I really can't wait to. I'm anxious to get my piece out of the way, and then I can just kind of chill and hang out. I'm here with my wife, Katie, who's my best friend and my companion in sobriety and the best AA I know. And she was, stand up. You know, it's kind of dark up here. Would it be possible to turn those lights up here? I don't know. I mean, no. Okay. All right. Imagine it's a little brighter up here. That's Katie right there. I told Lowell, I said, I wish they'd turn those lights up. He goes, you want to do something about the ballet and the orchestra too while you're at it? You know. See, you teach it to, they just feed it right back to you, you know. I mean, that's not right. But no, Lowell knew an awful lot when I met him. This 32nd year of this conference, that's very impressive, yeah. And I hardly ever address the topic of the weekend, you know, because you never know what it's going to be. But the jumping off place has special meaning to me. You know, it comes from page 152 of our big book. I'm a little bit of I always say I'm an unapologetic big book thumper. And all this is here is a large print copy of the big book that my sponsor took the stories out of the back and leather bound for me. But it's just a large print copy of the big book. And this book doesn't wait long to start making promises to a drunk like me. Right here on the title page. It says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Isn't that funny? I mean, already on the title page, it's saying something that's different from what I've been hearing for a long time. You know, that I don't care whether you say recovered, recovering. I mean, one of the things that's funny about AA is sometimes, you know, I always say in AA, whenever we form a firing squad, we always form a circle. You know, so we got some of our best members, you know, picking each other off over whether it's recovered or recovering or sponsee or protege or, you know, but I do like the Big Book, and I'm a big fan of the Big Book, and I have experience in AA I've had varying levels of involvement with the AA Big Book in my sobriety, and I hope that we get to talk about that some. But this topic of the jumping off place is on 152 in the Big Book, and it talks about, it says he'll be unable, he can't imagine life without alcohol. And I was that way for a good while before I got here. I knew I was alcoholic for a good while before I got to this fellowship. But then it goes further. But that's not what brought me to AA, knowing that I was alcoholic. It goes further to say one day he'll be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few men do. He'll be at the jumping off place. He'll wish for the end. That's what brought me into AA. That's that turning point. That's that spot where I can't imagine. There's no friendly direction. I can't keep drinking the way I've been drinking, and I can't imagine not drinking. And that's a tough spot, and I know you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. I like to start off with a little joke, and just to loosen everything up, especially me. And you know, there's a joke I've been telling. I love it. Some of you may have heard this joke before. Some of you may have heard me tell this joke before. But it's a good joke, and I like the way I tell it. So it's about this, because you know, we talk about coming from our experience, and we talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I'm also a big fan of the part in the book where it says in our personal stories, you'll find from the person's own point of view, how they establish their relationship with God. And I really hope we talk about that some this afternoon. But we're talking about coming from our own experience. It always reminds me, there's this guy that he's driving along one day, and he sees a sign on this gatepost at an old farmhouse, and it says, "Talking dog for sale." And he can't stand it. He goes up to the door, and the guy's sitting there, and he goes, "So you got a talking dog?" And the guy goes, "Yeah, he's around back." And so he wanders around back, and there's this red hound dog laying there, and he says, so you can talk?" The dog says, "Well, I certainly can." And he goes, "How did that happen?" And he said, "Well, it's an interesting story." He said, "When I was young, I started picking up some of the language, and as I got older, I started developing some of the nuances of the language and slang and colloquialism, and it developed into a very interesting life for me." He said, I had a 19-year career with the Drug Enforcement Administration, and I was able to infiltrate some situations that no human agent would have ever been able to get into. And he said, "You know, I've stayed in some of the finest hotels of the world, and I've eaten the cooking of the finest chefs in the world. But really, you know, enough about me. I'll tell you what's really interesting. Some of my pups have developed foreign language skills and have become international diplomats. And, you know, I have one pup that's in the United Nations right now that I'm very proud of." And the guy goes, "My God," he says, "it's just been fascinating talking to you." And he goes back around where the farmer's sitting there, and he goes, "How much do you want for a dog like that?" And the guy goes, "I don't know, $40? And he goes, "Why would you sell a fantastic dog like that for $40? And the guy goes, "Oh, none of that crap he told you is true." You know? It's kind of like that around here. It doesn't matter how good the story is if it's not my experience, you know. So that's what I hope to talk about. I'm gonna sit down right there. I better get drinking. I got a lot of ground to cover here. You know, Eileen gave me a special permit, so in the 2.5 hours I've been allotted here this morning, I hope to cover a lot of ground here. I come from Dallas, Texas, and I come from a pretty normal family. We live in Austin now. My home group is the Primary Purpose Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Austin, Texas. We meet on Tuesday nights. If you're ever in Austin on a Tuesday night, come see us. I hope to try to show you the same kind of hospitality you guys have been showing us here. But we are a line-by-line Big Book study. We study the Big Book week after week, line-by-line, and it's just a lot more fun than it sounds like. We average over 200 people on a Tuesday night studying the Big Book, and I think it's just a good sign that Alcoholics Anonymous is making a big comeback in AA, and I'm very excited about it. You know, I sobered up in the mid-80s. I've cried on my teddy bear. I've done all that stuff, but I mean, I really think that real alcoholics are hungry for real solution, and that's what I love to talk about. I come from Dallas. I come from a pretty normal family. My father was a salesman. My mother was a first grade school teacher for 42 years. I was darn darn well prepared for the first grade. I kind of kicked ass a little bit, you know. I don't know what a normal family is exactly, but I've heard enough Fifth Steps over the years to know that a lot of people had it a lot worse than I did growing up. I mean, there wasn't anybody drinking in our house. We were Southern Baptists, you know, whatever it is, we're against it. But there wasn't any drinking. And everybody's going to work. Nobody's knocking each other around, you know. I did grow up under the burden of potential. Anybody else experience that while you were coming here? You know, I mean, oh my God, I used to hear, why can't you be more like Charles Malira across the street? You know, why can't you apply yourself? Why can't you live up to your potential? And I remember thinking, that's really flattering, Mom. I'm really not holding back that much, but, you know, kind of getting my best shot here, you know, but I'm glad you think so much of me, but... I had a sister 5.5 years older than I am that was perfect. She was a National Honor Society, first chair flautist, drum majorette, you name it. You know, she was it. And then there's this kind of thuggish little brother. And none of that stuff made me alcoholic. But I will tell you that 12 years of heavy drinking and use of outside issues will significantly lower people's expectations of you. By the time I got here, it was like, oh, for God's sakes, just get a job. You know, I mean, it's like, never mind a career or a profession, just get off the couch, you know. Oh, my God, you know, I mean, the high point of my day was the Three Stooges in the morning, you know, and then the Untouchables, that was pretty good. But none of that stuff made me an alcoholic. What does? I mean, because I have experienced the greatest gift God can give an alcoholic like me, and that's recovery from alcoholism. And, you know, when we talk about being a recovered alcoholic, what are we talking about? Because the book very clearly says we're not cured of alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So what is it, if they're talking about having recovered, and it's throughout the book, it talks about recovered, you know, you should be introduced as a man who has recovered. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are 100 men and women who have recovered from what? From a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. What are they talking about? As an alcoholic, and I didn't know this for a long time. I didn't know this for a good while sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent a good deal of time raising my hand saying, my name's Charlie and I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't really know what it meant. You know, now I figure if there is such a thing as an alcoholic, surely I must be one, because I didn't know anybody that drank more than I did. I've met a few since I got here, but you know, at the time, you know, I mean, as I'm talking, there will be times where I'll say we're going to get back to that later. And what that means is this is not the appropriate time to introduce that piece of information. But I got a little ADD working up here. And when I tell you we're going to get back to it later, we're probably not coming back. You know, it's like I always get real excited when I actually circle back around to one. You know, But let's stick on the other thing about what makes me an alcoholic. Because, you know, it's funny. Most of us have experienced, you know, saying that I'm never going to drink again. And, you know, when our family would say, you know, and then the next thing you know, we're drinking. And they'd always ask that question. They'd always say, why did you do it? Why did you start drinking again? And we give them the only answer we got, which is what? It's like a chorus throughout Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm telling you, that is the, I don't know. God almighty, I don't know. I don't know. It's just what I do. I just, you know, I mean, I'm just screw up. I hurt people. And so by the time I get here, I was really thinking there was something wrong with me. You know, I mean, you know, not, you know, disease my butt. It's like, there's something wrong with me because, you know, so... But what is it that makes me an alcoholic? As an alcoholic, and I like to take a little bit of time on this. How many people in the room today have less than a year of sobriety? Just for my own, just by a show of hands. Welcome. Welcome. I only, as an alcoholic, I've only got two problems with alcohol. One happens to me when I drink it. The other one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I really don't struggle with alcohol. It only gives me trouble when I'm drinking it or when I'm not drinking it. And the first piece of it is the physical part of the disease of alcoholism, and it's beautifully described in the doctor's opinion in the first 23 pages of the big book, where it talks about this physical reaction that I have to drinking, and they describe it as the phenomenon of craving. It says on Roman numeral 28, it says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Never. My sister's not alcoholic. She doesn't have this phenomenon of craving. When she drinks, it doesn't do to her what it does to me. And the book calls it a phenomenon of craving. It calls it an allergy, which is just an abnormal reaction to something. And when I drink, something happens that ain't regular. When I drink, it triggers a craving for more drinking. Now, the problem is I could never identify this. This is all language that I've never used on my way to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I never once walked into the Spillway Pub there in Northeast Dallas and went, oh, Bobby. God Almighty, the spiritual malady is on me today. You know, and I had a beer on the way over here, and it has triggered a phenomenon of craving that is just kicking my young butt. You know, I mean, I never thought I'd experience the phenomenon of craving. I just thought I changed my mind. You know, you ever go in just to have a couple of drinks and then you change your mind? I mean, you know, I'm just going to go in, I'm going to have a couple. Well, it turns out two was a bad number. You know, I mean, seven. Is a pretty good number. I'll never forget that Katie and I were in Vegas at a halfway house carrying a little meeting in there, and there was this guy. He didn't know he was saying anything funny, but we were all just talking, and he goes, man, it sucks I'm an alcoholic. I mean, he goes, I wish I wasn't an alcoholic so I could drink all the time. I was like, my man right there. You know, the one thing I really like doing, and I can't do it, you know. I mean, you know, but I got this physical reaction to drinking that doesn't happen to my sister. When she drinks, it doesn't, you know, it trigger that craving that happens to me. You know, and it's a big problem, but it's not my biggest problem. You know, if my biggest problem was what happens to me when I drink 4 ounces of vodka, what would my answer be? Don't drink 4 ounces of vodka. You know, did that work for anybody? You know, imagine if we brought you in here and go, okay, listen, you got a body that ain't regular, Rich. Whenever you take a drink, it's going to trigger a craving that you're not going to be able to control in the long run. It's a big problem. Quit it, you know. But that brings in the second piece of alcohol. It says on page 23 that all this, all these observations we've been making about what happens when I drink wouldn't mean anything if I never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, we think the main problem the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. Boom, the second piece of alcohol starts on page 23 that I have a mind that is always going to convince me to get drunk again, every time. That's a tough spot. And it goes on, you know, well, to recover from that is about as big a deal as you can get. You know, I'm a big fan of singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know much about it for a long time, but when we talk about outside issues, you know, I mean, I have deep experience with a lot of things. I guess the shortest version of my story is that the people that I drank with thought I did too many outside issues, and the people that I did outside issues with were shocked by my drinking. You know, so everybody thought Charlie was getting a little bit too loaded. But when we talk about singleness of purpose, what are we talking about? It's not, you know, it's not that we're trying to keep, you know. AA is a one-trick pony. We are alcoholics working with alcoholics. And, you know, and the reason that's important is funny because I heard about it for a long time, but I didn't know what it meant. I think it's worth mentioning. You know, because The thing about it is, it's this identification that takes place when one drunk talks to another one. It talks about it on page 18. It talks about how we will lie to our family and our psychiatrists and doctors. We got to be the only group of people that will go pay a psychiatrist $200 an hour and then lie to them the whole time. You know, I mean, you know, do you drink? Well, maybe a couple of beers, you know, if I'm mowing the grass or something, you know. Like I've mowed the grass lately, you know. I mean, but it says that wives, doctors, and wives and family and intimate friends find us more unapproachable than do the doctor and the psychiatrist. And it goes on. This is heavy. It's on page 18. Let me get out my glasses. Bought these over at the Ace Hardware this morning. How am I doing? That's what happens if you stay sober a while. Your arms get too short. It says, but back to this identification and singleness of purpose, it says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who's properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of a new man in a matter of hours. And here's where it gets heavy. It goes on to say, until such an identification is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. What did he say? He said, until that identification of one drunk talking to another one is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. By the time I got here, plenty of people had wanted to talk to me about my drinking, but it wasn't anybody that drank like I did. You know, and when this identification takes place, I'm willing to take action that I may not even believe in yet if you're saying it's what you did to get over drinking, and I can tell you drank like I did, you know? So it's funny. You'll never hopefully hear any of my sponsees saying I'm an alcoholic and anything else, because it doesn't apply. If I'm in an AA meeting, what we're identifying as is alcoholics. There's a ton of 12-step fellowships out there. There's Alcoholics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous. There's even a Lip Balm Addicts Anonymous program I've heard about, in case anybody suffered from that heartbreaking malady, you know. Well, that's where every time you say that, you see somebody with their Carmex going, oh, I feel you, brother. I know exactly where you're coming from, you know. But out of all these 12-step fellowships, the only difference in any of them is the first half of the first step and the middle part of the 12th step. What I'm powerless over and who I carry the message to, because this identification is so important. Saying I'm an alcoholic and an addict is like saying I'm an alcoholic and a Texan or an alcoholic and a contractor. It's not what we're identifying as in the rooms. You know, well, one of my favorite things to do with singleness of purpose is Katie and I are very fortunate. We get to move around a lot in AA. We get to go to a lot of wonderful weeks. I will tell you, not every place we go is like this. You guys have got something really special going on here. There's a very special energy in this place. I heard about it long before we got here. We were in Lafayette, Louisiana last week, and some of our folks that were there were saying, oh, you're going to like that conference a lot, and I can see why they said it. But one of the things I like to do is, like, whenever you go to a conference, they'll say, we're going to send so-and-so to pick you up at the airport. And so you get on the phone with the guy, and he goes, hi, I'm you know, so-and-so, I'll be at the airport to pick you up. And I go, don't even tell me. Don't even tell me. It's just something I like to do. Just be in baggage claim. We land at 2:15, you know, and I can't tell you how many times we've come down the little escalator, talking about identification, come down the little escalator and you look over and you go, that's our boy right there. And you walk over there and you go, are you Tim? And he goes, yeah, how'd you know? And he goes, that's why geographic cures don't work for guys like us, because you can plop me down in Phoenix and I'll go, he looks like he parties, you know, and here we go, you know. But, I drank an awful lot. The book says men and women drink essentially, Eileen referred to it, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Any argument on that one? You know, I mean, I think it's a little understated. You know, I mean, I like banana pudding, you know. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. From the very first time I got loaded, I remember thinking, oh, we're going to do this a lot. And from the time, I'd like to tell you, just like Eileen said, I'd like to tell you that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day from the time I was 16. We actually used the same amount of time. I used for 12 years, from the time I was 16 until I was 28 years old. And I'd like to tell you that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day of that time, but that wouldn't be true. But, and this isn't everybody's story in AA, but what I can tell you is true for me is that from the time I was 16 till the time I quit for what I hope is the last time, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time under any circumstances for any reason. That's not everybody's story in AA, but it was mine. Never, I don't have any memory of ever going, what we, oh no, it's my mom's birthday today, you know, or I got to be somewhere in November or something, you know, I mean, it was just like you described, it's on, you know, and I went through different things, I mean, but, well, I'm not going to talk about that. Well, maybe a little bit. This is a departure from the singleness of purpose thing, but the stuff you hear a lot of this stuff like the phenomenon of craving, mental obsession, that sort of thing, and you hear stuff that comes out of the treatment centers that sometimes makes me giggle a little bit. And one of them is you hear people talking about my drug of choice was this. Anybody heard that? Did anybody talk like that before you got here? You know, I always laugh thinking about this guy sitting over at one of his partner's houses, and the guy goes, look, and he goes, what do you got there? Oh, no, that's not my particular drug of choice. You know, I was like, you boys go ahead and enjoy yourself. I'm just going to stay over here and wait for my DOC to appear. You know, I was like, whatever you got is fine. You know, but I'm clearly alcoholic. I I've always felt like all that stuff was as a result of my alcoholism. I've done a lot of things in and out of sobriety to try to treat that spiritual malady. That I don't know exactly how to describe the spiritual malady, but I know in AA when you talk about that black hole, that feeling of separation, that feeling of less than, people in AA nod their heads like they know it. And it's as close as I can come to describing the spiritual malady. But you know, I drank for a long time, and things were great for a while, and then they weren't, you know, and somewhere along the line, it started getting ugly. I started having more and more consequences. I left a bar in a blackout one night, and I crashed into I was a blackout drinker. I really thought you were supposed to be. I was, like she was saying earlier, to me, it was always about getting loaded. I was never a social drinker. I was always about getting trashed, and so I blacked out regularly. Katie was a brownout drinker, but I blacked out a lot. And you know, one night I left this bar in a blackout, and there was a collision, and that's what woke me up. you ever come to behind the wheel of a car? You know, and I'd crashed into something, and I could see the fender, and it was sticking up, but I'm still rolling, so I kept my foot on the gas, and I go around the corner, and I park the car. Now, Katie thinks it's an important part of the story for me to tell you that it was my mother's car. I was so poorly treated as a child that I ran away from home for good at the age of 28. I'm serious. Never went back, you know. You know, but I come out of this blackout, you know, and I go park the car, so I grab my shoes. For some reason, my shoes were off, and I'm running back towards the bar to report the car stolen. And there's a, and you know, and the thing I need to say is this was not an extraordinary night. You know, this was just kind of a day in the life of Charlie Parker at this point. You know, and so I'm running back to the bar to report the car stolen. And as I'm running under this row of trees, I looked over where I'd hit the car, and there was twinkling glass everywhere. And the reason it was twinkling because these two cops were standing there with their flashlights, and they're shining on the street, and you can see all the glass. And as I'm running, I'm thinking, man, they got here really fast. You know, and I run back to the bar, and I report the car stolen. And the next day they go, Mr. Parker, you're going to have to take a polygraph test in order to get your car out of the pound. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, it was involved in an accident before it was reported stolen. And I said, you're kidding. And they said, no, they ran into a parked police car. And I remember thinking, that explains how they got there so fast, you know? Because I've been a little foggy on that one, you know? But, you know, Norm Alpe was mentioned earlier. Norm Alpe used to talk about how our lives were named, saved and changed by seconds and inches. And one example there, if those cops had been unfortunate enough to be standing behind that car, you may have a different speaker here 29 years later. You know, I had a lot of lucky breaks. Things were a lot different back then. We were talking about it at lunch. You had to wreck the car and be knee-walking drunk to get a DWI back then. I mean, they ain't playing these days. I mean, it's, you know, two beers and off we go, you know. We used to be able to carry a Budweiser on the dashboard, you know, and things were a little different, you know. I look back at all the breaks I had, but, you know, things are starting to get a little ugly. And somewhere along the line, I started losing the power of choice and control. It talks about it on page 24 of the big book. It says, at some point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. It's interesting. Most of us know the only requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking. Desire to stop drinking will get me a front row seat in any AA meeting in the world. But right here on page 24, it tells me it won't do a darn thing to keep me sober. It says the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The fact is that most alcoholics have lost the power of choice and drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. I am unable at certain times to call into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I'm without defense against the first drink. And that doesn't matter whether that's my suffering and humiliation or my family's suffering and humiliation. It's not going to keep a real alcoholic sober because I've lost the power of choice and control. Somewhere along the line, I crossed this invisible line. I don't know when it happened. I think that's why they call it an invisible line. But I was a pawn shop guy. Any other pawn shoppers here today? All right, my man, right there. You know, I loved everything about pawn shops. I loved the purity of the equation. I liked, you know, there's no shame in their game. You know, I never remember walking into a pawn shop and having them go, "What are you going to do with this money?" You know, or, "Good God, man, weren't you just here this morning?" You know, or you know, it wasn't like that at all. You just take them the deer rifle and they give you the money, and then you take the shotgun and they give you the money. And now, we alcoholics make some really good plans. We really do. You know, I mean, we make plans that you could take over and show to the business school, and they would go, "Pretty solid plan." You know, I mean, and our plans work right up till they quit working. You know, now my plan was I had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop, and you could usually keep that cycle going by pulling some kind of a deal or some kind of a scam or something to get everything. Now, I should tell you that I didn't own very much stuff, so I'm having to pawn things that don't belong to me, and that puts a little extra heat on the equation, you know, and so one day I pull a scam and I got enough money to get everything out of the pawn shop, and I'm just going to go by and settle my tab at the Spillway Pub. You know, they would let me run a $60 tab. I'm not going crazy. I got a lot of ground to cover, but it's important to settle your tab at the only place that'll let you run a tab. And so I go in there and I come out of a 5-day blackout. Now, I didn't have many of those. This was 5 days where I remember one incident from the whole 5 days. And I come out of this blackout, and I'm, you know, I hear people talking about coming out of blackouts in Vegas in a hot tub with, you know, but I was on the edge of the bed at my mother's house, you know, but I come out of this blackout and I got $8 in this pocket and I got all those pawn tickets in the other pocket. And I just remember going, "Oh no. Oh no." Because I shot my wad on that last scam, and now I got nothing. And my dad was a good man. My dad worked hard for his stuff. Nobody was giving him his stuff. And I knew this was wrong, you know. And so I would have to go to my father, who I respected a great deal, and go, "Dad, listen, if we act now, I can get you a pretty good deal on all your stuff, you know. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail, you know. And if there are Al-Anon, how many Al-Anons are in the room today? I love the Al-Anons. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here. Most of us would be dead if it wasn't. We know when I sobered up, it was popular to make jokes about the Al-Anons and stuff, and I never did think that was funny. I mean, besides, most of us would be dead. I mean, they're the only group of people that loves us, you know? I mean, but if you're Al-Anon and you're here, believe me, we know that story ain't funny, you know? But I have to tell it like it's a joke, or I'll just bust up. Now, I do have to warn you, I'm a big guy. I'm a competitive shotgun shooter. I'm a Harley rider. I'm liable to cry like a little girl in a pink dress up here at any moment, you know. So I just warn you. It doesn't mean that, you know, I'm mentally ill, but most of the time it's when I look back and I either think of the desperation in my life, or I look back and I see the undeniable hand of God working in my life. And both of those, whoo, both of those choke me up. This day I have to go to my dad, and we get in and so the thing about it is, the reason I tell this story is because we would get in his car, and Dallas is a big spread out town like Los Angeles, so it wasn't just go to the pawn shop. It was like, we got to go over on Buckner Boulevard and get your shotgun, and I left your deer rifle out on Bellon Road, and the metal detectors are in Oak Cliff, and your sterling silver is on East Grand, and we got to go to Garland Road to get, you know. And so it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And while we were riding along, I would be going, Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. I don't ever want to feel like this. I don't ever want you to feel like this. I will never do this again. What I didn't know, riding in his truck with him, was that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. When I was promising him that I would never do this again, I might as well have promised him that I could flap my wings up here today and fly around this room and come back and land on the stage, because I did not have the power to make good on that promise. In the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we talk about unmanageability, I don't care whether you can balance your checkbook or keep a job or get kicked. The thing I see the book asking is, can you or can you not manage the decision to stop drinking when you really want to? For me, the answer was no. And then the book goes on to say whether or not you can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which you've lost the power to choose whether you drink or not. For me, it was my only shot, but I didn't know it. Well, I wound up in AA, I think it's important to tell you, that's how slick I was when I got to AA. That's how cool I was. I was a burden to everybody that was unfortunate enough to care about me, and I was completely hopeless and couldn't get through one day without getting loaded. That's what I brought to you, good people. I come to AA, and I did a lot of stuff. I had a good sponsor. We did the steps, my first step passed through the steps. We missed a lot. Mark Houston was my sponsor later in life, and I'm definitely going to talk about him, because I had my biggest spiritual awakening at 17 years of sobriety. But in this first pass, Mark Houston came into our lives and saved and changed the lives of Katie and I. I can say it without any reservation. Took AA to a level that I had never experienced before, and I definitely want to talk about that, because my life is not even anywhere close to what it was during those first 17 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I want to briefly talk about my first pass through the steps was that I'm an alcoholic, okay? Do you believe there could be some sort of a power? All right, we got past that one. And then on the third step, we basically went, you know, we read, and at the end of how it works, we read the A, B, and C. It says A, that we're alcoholic and cannot manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. And that's when somewhere along the line we started chanting like a bunch of kids at summer camp. You know, I mean, talk about a soapbox. Well, for God's sake, you know, I just want to say a little bit about the chanting. You don't have to do it. You know, I mean, it came in through the treatment centers, you know, and it's all well-intentioned. Nobody's trying to, you know, throw a monkey wrench in the deal. But, you know, when I got here, you know, we would say, we'd do the Lord's Prayer and we'd go, keep coming back. Okay, that's what everybody says in AA. All right, keep coming back. Then they started going, keep coming back, it works. And then they started going, keep coming back. It works. If you work it, and you're worth it, so work it. And I'm like, oh, for God's sake. You know, I mean, you know, I always picture the new guy coming in going, oh, my God, you know, I want to stop drinking whiskey, but do I really have to do this whole shave and a haircut, two bits, you know, and you know, all this stuff. I mean, I'm just saying you don't have to do it, you know. I mean, you know, really, it's funny. Some of my buddies have started going, stay. And I'm like, all that is a shorter version of chanting. It's still chanting. You know, I mean, turns out, amen is a kick-ass way to end a prayer. You know? I mean, people have been doing it for a long time. You know? We're the only group of people that takes the Lord's Prayer and goes, I think we could put a little flavor on the end of it. You know? I mean, we could just, I think we can do this a little better than Jesus. You know? I'm just saying, you know, but after that see that God could and would if he were sought, we went right from to the third step prayer, got down on the knees. I think it's one of the biggest mistakes being made in AA, if there are any mistakes being made in AA, was that we went right from, do you believe there could be a power that could help you, to the third step prayer, and let's get you right in inventory. And I wrote inventory, and my first inventory was basically just a confession. And then, you know, I did a fifth step. I felt a lot better. And then I felt, you know, much more a part of the human race to have a common experience with this guy that was talking. Six and seven, you just kind of phone those in, you know. I mean, it's funny. I was on a plane yesterday coming from Austin to San Jose, and I go back, and I'm waiting to get in the bathroom, and the flight attendant, he says, where are you going? And I said, we're going out to Portland and driving over. And why? I said, well, it's an AA conference. I've quit even trying to be subtle about it. I just, you know, we're going to an Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, I have 2.5 years sober. And I said, okay. So I go to work, you know, and I go, where are you at in the step work? He goes, well, I mean, I pretty much just, you know, well, that's not a good sign, you know. And he says, I'm on 6 and 7. You know, I'm pretty much on 6. And I go, I could have been that guy. I could have been that guy. There was a time when I could have said that. And the reason I would have said that I was on 6 is because the last step I took any action on was 5. You know? And I'm running along. Now, I made some amends. And I did, on the 10th step, if I really hurt your feelings or obviously screwed up, I'd say something about it and I'd make amends for it. 11th step, the meditation, you know, you keep a little reflections on the back of the toilet and, you read it in the morning and you go, okay, God, see you tomorrow. And, you know, and off we go. And that was on a good day, you know. And then I'm carrying the message. And, well, let's just say I slipped into some untreated alcoholism. And I come back in, you know, well, I want to cover a little extra ground here, you know. In the hour and a half I have left here, I went into a period of untreated alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened to me was I hit the wall at 4.5 years sober. I blew up a marriage. I got a child support payment. I wait the appropriate amount of time to get into another relationship, right? 14 days. And I get, now I should tell you, Katie and I were litter mates in AA. She's got 5.5 months more than I do, and she thinks it's a really big deal, you know. But we sobered up together, and she and I were like brother and sister for 20 years. I mean, no flirtation, no innuendo, nothing. We were like best friends, brother and sister type bond for 20 years. I was at her wedding. I knew all her kids. I mean, our kids grew up together. And then she'll tell you more about it tomorrow afternoon, but we became a couple about 11 years ago. But there's still a lot of that brother and sister energy in our relationship. And it's kind of funny to watch sometimes, because sometimes that doesn't all that pulling the pigtail stuff doesn't always translate real well into a relationship. But, I can't help it. You know, one day we were having a little discussion, and she goes, okay, you're starting to bug me. And I go, oh, honey. That would kill me, you know. I don't think I could live with myself if I thought I was bugging you, you know. And she goes, yeah, now you're really bugging me, you know. But anyway, Let's just say that some of these relationships I was in, Katie didn't necessarily approve of, you know, and I didn't care. You know, she was like my kid sister. The more it bugged her, the more I liked it. But I blow up another relationship, and I started slipping in. I think I'm trying to do it your way. And Mark used to say, how do you know what you don't know? And I missed so much in the book. I thought I was a big book guy, you know, and I missed so much. So at 7 years, I kind of pull in. I hit the wall again, and I pull away from the deal. It's almost like I told myself, you know, I've tried it your way, and I'm getting knocked to the mat every time I step into the ring. I'm still very much about staying sober. I'm still very much about going to the meetings and that sort of thing. But we're going to lighten up on the rigorous honesty just a little bit, you know. And I went into this really flat period in AA. Nothing serious, you know, a little wire fraud, a little, you know, you know, stuff like that. But I mean, it's business, you know, and tax fraud is just, you know, we just won't talk about that, you know, and you know, that sort of thing. And you hang with people that will support that. We call them unsigned death pacts we make with each other. You know, if I'm running around on my wife, well, I'm not going to hang with people that are working the principles of this program. I'm going to find somebody that says, look, you don't say anything about my infidelity. I won't say anything to you about your gambling. Nod your head if you understand what I'm saying. We are not going to talk about that, you know. And we form these unsigned death pacts with each other, and we're killing each other by not holding us accountable to the level of behavior that we could be if we have spiritual consent with each other. But I'm going to roll back around to that in a minute. What happened to me was I get into this dishonest marriage, and what's funny is from the outside, it was everything. My mother was very big on outside appearances, and out of all the relationships I've been in, she was most proud of this one because this person was a managing director of a major bulge bracket bank on Wall Street, and we had a penthouse apartment in Manhattan, and we had a beach house in the Hamptons, and we're going all over the world, and everything looks really good from the outside, but it was bogus, and the most bogus thing about it was me, you know, because I'd sold out my values. Mark used to say most people arrange their behavior around their values. He said we lower our standards to match our behavior. Think about that one for a minute. So I wasn't even acting outside of my ideal because I had slammed my values to the floor where everything is okay to be doing this sort of thing. But I knew something was wrong, and I'm getting more and more uncomfortable. And I was always about to get out of that marriage, and I was in that marriage for 12 years. One day we chartered a plane to fly from East Hampton out on Eastern Long Island into New York City, and we're going to go to dinner. I had a couple in from South Carolina, and we're going to look at Long Island from the air, and we're going to go in and have a fancy dinner in New York City. And so we get in this. Now, I knew couples that chartered planes out to the Hamptons every weekend for 20 years. This is the first time I ever chartered a plane, ever. And we take off from East Hampton, we're flying along, and we're going out over the Peconic Bay, and it's and I'm looking around, and I feel like I'm in a soap bubble 3,000 feet up in the air. I'm sitting in the co-pilot seat. I am not a co-pilot, you know, and I put on the little headphones, and what you don't want to hear your pilot saying when you put on your headphones is, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And they say, you're cleared to Gabretzky. And I look, and there's an airport right here at 10 o'clock. There's a runway right there. There's the water, trees, runway. And he says, you don't understand. I've lost engine power. I can't make land. We're going to have to ditch. And I'm like, what? I mean, I'm a gambler my whole life. What are the odds of that? You know, I mean, the first time we ever charter a plane, we're going to crash into the drink at night. And he turns it in, and he comes in, and he says, brace for impact. Anybody know how to do that? you know, so we come in, and all of a sudden, boosh, we hit the water. And, I mean, it's just spray and noise and like splash down at Six Flags times 1,000. And the windshield comes in, the cowling comes off, glass all in my face and my head, and then absolute silence. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I think we're going to be okay. Well, this wasn't much of an airplane. Really crappy boat, you know? I mean, right about the time I think, oh my God, I feel something on my knee. And it goes, well, my door won't come open. And I go up to get air, and there's nothing but water in the roof of the plane. And I remember thinking, so that's it. I die in this airplane today. Well, go back underwater, the door comes open. When I grabbed the roof of the plane and I felt my feet pull free, I'd like to tell you that my first thought was, I got to get my wife and these other people out of here. My first thought was, I'm out. I'm out. And I went back down and got my wife out. Went back down and got the dog. The only non-survivor, the whole length, there was five adults and the dog, and the only non-survivor was this little Cavalier King Charles puppy we had. Came very close to dying that day. You know, and we were on CNN with Anderson Cooper, live from the headlines with Anderson Cooper and all this, and people all over the country going, it's Charlie, you know, on CNN, you know. I mean, but I get home that night and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that I was in a plane crash tonight. I mean, it's no Earl Hightower story, but it was pretty dramatic as far as I was concerned, you know. And the reason I tell all that is because something about an incident like that will make you start looking at things differently. And I come back and I call, there's a guy, and I had become aware of how self-centered I was. You know, I was struggling with it, you know, as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember calling up John Henry, this guy there in Austin, and I said, John Henry, my God, man, I am so self-centered. I can't even be in a conversation with anybody. You know, I have to just force myself to go, how are the kids, you know, and act like I give a flip about the answer. Now, I know this probably doesn't happen in Oregon, but I didn't care, you know. All I care about was me. All of my childhood memories are about me. I don't have any memories of the struggles my sister had or my parents were going through. Well, it turns out it's mentioned in our book, you know, I come back and we start getting in the book. I 12-stepped a friend of mine, and he met this one-eyed guy from Texas, and we started talking to each other. Now our conversations are, next thing you know, I'm going out to the ranch, this treatment center with John Henry, and I'm carrying a message to guys, and I swear to God, I'm 17 years sober, and there were times where I felt like I was a step ahead of these guys. There were times where it felt like I would go home and read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and I'd go home and read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. And I'm calling up Tom, and I'm going, hey, man, what do you do when they say this? He goes, well, you know, have you ever talked about the devilments? No, where's that? It's on page 52. You know, and all this, where our conversations are starting to be about how to carry this message, how to have a deeper experience with this stuff. And about that time, we go to a Big Book workshop. A friend of mine called and he says, hey man, I heard something about a Big Book workshop in Dallas. And Katie's husband has passed by this time, and we're both just trying to get back into this deal at a deeper level. But this guy calls and he says, I heard about a Big Book study in Dallas. And I look, and somebody sends me a flyer, and it says Mark H. and this other guy. And I called Katie. I said, you know, I don't know this other guy, but Mark is Chris's sponsor, and I really like Chris. I bet we'd like Mark. And so what's crazy is we got in the truck and drove 230 miles to go to a Big Book weekend. We wouldn't have even been terrifically fired up about a Big Book meeting at that time, you know? I mean, I want a meeting where I get to share, you know? But we go up there, and I'll never forget it. Mark Houston. Mark Houston saved our lives. The power of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was spoken right through that man to us. The power of God spoke directly to us through him. And he was sitting there in that workshop. And I mean, at one point, I remember leaning over to Katie and going, my God, what book is he reading from? You know, I've never heard any of this stuff he's talking about. You know, and I mean, oh my God, the whole weekend. I mean, it was unbelievable. You know, I mean, and you know, to say that I'd missed a lot. You know, after that ABC I'm okay. You know, that ABC that we read in the book, you know what the next line is after that? It says, being convinced, we were at step 3. Well, I'm reading the book now. I'm 17 years sober, and I'm reading the book. And it says, being convinced, we're step three, which we decided to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. And then it asks two what I think are very fair questions for the new person to ask. What do you mean by that? And what do you want me to do? What do you mean, turn my will over? How do I do it? And then it goes on in the next line. I'll never forget it. You ever see those lines that just leap off the page at you? And it says, the first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives were good. And I'm sitting, I'll never forget reading that and going, my God, not only have I never been convinced of that, that line has never touched me, because we went right from do you believe there could be a power to doing the third step prayer, and we missed this entire body of work on pages 60 to 63. It's really not very important. It's just the root of our problem and the basis of our recovery for the rest of our lives. Other than that, just skip it, and so what happened, it changes everything. I mean, it is an absolute game changer, because now it turns out, it goes on to, it says, I remember one time I was doing a workshop in Idaho, and this guy, the taper, had heard one of Katie's talks, and he came out, and we were sitting around with a group of guys like this, and he comes out and he goes, this guy's wife did an hour-long talk on step three and never mentioned the third step prayer. And I'm like, Yeah, we could do that. I could do that all the time. But there was a time when it'd be like, a guy came up to me doing a workshop in Arizona, and he goes, how are you going to do an hour on step three? I mean, what is there to step three other than the third step prayer? And it's like this body of work that prepares me for the third step prayer is unbelievable, and it's an absolute game changer, and I missed it for 17 years as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's a selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our problem. And it goes on to say our problems of our own making, one of the biggest promises in the big book, because if my problems are of y'all's making, the only way I'm going to be okay is if I can get all of y'all to act right. Now, that, if you're not from Texas, that's the plural form of y'all. All y'all. And so, but if my problems are of my own making, me and this power got a chance of making it okay. And it goes on to say something that blew my mind. It says, above everything, we have to get rid of this selfishness. Mark could look you right in the eye and go, what does the words above everything mean to you? Isn't it interesting? It doesn't say above everything, I got to stop drinking vodka. Turns out vodka never was my problem. Vodka was the only thing that I'd ever found that would ease the pain of a life based completely on selfishness and self-centeredness. It's like Chuck Chamberlain used to tell a story about this guy that was afraid of dogs. And when he looked at it, he remembered that when he was a kid, this neighborhood dog had bitten him. But he said as he inventoried it further, he remembered that he'd been chasing one of the neighborhood girls across her yard when her dog came out and bit him. And he said, all my life I'd been running from dogs and chasing women, and dogs never were my problem, That was exactly my experience with AA. I'd been working a program like the problem was alcohol, meeting-based sobriety, going to the meetings, getting a little bit of relief, and I'm not drinking today. And you know that guy in your meetings. He's the one going, well, I screamed at my wife this morning, and I burned out of the driveway. I slapped one of the kids as I was going out the front door, and I burned out of the driveway, and I got to work an hour and a half late and looked at some internet porn at the office and played a little internet poker, left to work an hour early and ate a half gallon of Bluebell ice cream on the way home, but I didn't drink today, and by God, that makes me a winner, And you're like, no, that kind of makes you a Nimrod, pal, When you start working a program based on manifestations of self, it changes the whole thing. Now the third step's got some meat on it. And it says, relieve me of the bondage of self that I could better do your will. Take away my difficulties. Why? So I can chill? No, so I can better do thy will. It goes on in the fourth step to say, being convinced that self, manifested in various ways is what it defeated, but we looked at the common manifestations of self. The fourth step is now all about manifestations of self. When you get over to the amends process, it says now, and when we do that, see all those manifestations of self in the third column of a four-column inventory, when I do the fourth column, I got real stuff to take into six and seven that I'm asking God to take away from me. The things that you can't work with, take those away from me. I'm seeing how it's a problem in the fourth column, and now I go out and make my amends, and then if I missed all that other stuff about self, what did I do when I got to the line where it says being convinced that we attempted to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live life on self-will and run the show ourselves? It's a game changer. It changes everything. I mean, I went to Idaho to do this workshop, and I took a sponsee out there with me. I'll never forget, we were talking about all this stuff, 60 to 63. I mean, some of my sponsees must go, oh, no, I got a sponsor that's only read three pages out of the big book, you know, I mean, because we're always going back to 60 to 63. It's where we live, 60 to 63, 84 to 88. Well, I'm talking to this guy that picked us up at the airport. His name was Sean, and we're talking about selfishness and self-centeredness and the root of our problem and above everything and all this stuff and manifestation. Itself and how it shows up and how that's the root of our problem and how that's what we're working on. And we get over to this house and he's talking, we're having lunch, and he goes, man, he goes, my first wife, oh boy, was she crazy. And I go, and we're talking, and he goes, now my second wife, whoo, boy, she was nuts, right, you know. And then this chick I just broke up with about 3 months ago, oh my God, riding on the hood of my car, and you know, and all this stuff. And I'm sitting there and I go, you mind if I ask you a question? And he goes, no, go ahead. And his sponsor is sitting right behind him. And I said, how do you find yourself in a relationship with all these crazy women? And he goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, I mean, based on what we've been talking about, is it possible, I mean, were they crazy when you met them? Or is it possible that the only difference between the way they were when you met them and the way they were when you broke up with them was the effect of spending that amount of time with somebody as selfish and self-centered as you are? And his sponsor was sitting behind him. His sponsor goes, say that again. You know, and we get outside, and my sponsor goes, dang. And I was like, what? He goes, oh my God, we've been here like an hour. And you're like, boom. You know, and I said, that's my job, man. I'm the out of town guy. I come in, I drop the bombs, I go home, you know. Oh, my God, it's just an absolute game changer, because now when a sponsor is calling me with a 10th step, it's about, you know, how did you make decisions based on self that made you in a position to be harmed? Where did you set the ball rolling? You know, how can we look at this from an entirely different angle? All this work that takes place, it's an amazing process, and it's completely changed our whole lives. I mean, for the past 11 years, I've been absolutely on fire with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sponsoring a ton of guys. Our house is an AA household. We started the primary purpose group in Austin. We got over 200 people getting together, and the ripple effect of that through the community in AA in Austin has been unbelievable. And you watch it happen. You see people having a new experience and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, I almost missed it. If you'd have come to me when I had 17 years and said, Charlie, what's going to save your life and change your whole world is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous coming right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you, you're crazy. I've been in AA for 17 years. I know what AA has to offer me. I'm an NFL football fan. I assume we're all Dallas Cowboy fans here. Yeah, I thought so. You know, I've been a Cowboy fan since they were good. And, you know, and I used to have season tickets and all that stuff. Well, I sponsor a guy, and he calls me one day. He goes, hey, man, my family's got a box at the Dallas Cowboys Stadium. He says, you want to go up and watch them play the Eagles this Monday night? And I go, yes, I do. And so we go to the football game, and we park in a private little parking lot. We go in a special little entrance. We got bags of our own groceries we're carrying in with us. We go up this quiet little escalator into this civilized little hallway. We go into the skybox, and they're bringing in buckets of ice and trays of chocolate chip cookies. And I'm looking around. I don't know whether to be excited about being in this skybox or to be pissed off about having sat in the cheap seats for 20 years. That was exactly my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. After being around here for 17 years, I found out there was a level of this deal going on that I didn't even know about. I love the tapers. I love, Terry, I'm glad you're here. I'm a big fan of the tapers because a whole lot of my experience came from driving around listening to CDs of people that knew more about this stuff than I did. You know, and I love driving around and listening to stuff like that. When I say I almost missed it, you know, if you're new here, we love you. We hope you become a part of our fellowship. We hope you stay sober. But I think there's a ton of message for the new guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here to talk to the guy, if you've been around 3 years, 5 years, 15 years, 25 years, and you're not experiencing what you hear people talk about from these podiums, I'm telling you, it's still available. Our book says the most satisfying years of our existence lie ahead of us. I ask you to lay that up against your experience and see if that's what's happening. If it's not, if you are doing the work, I'm proud of you. If you're not, let's get to work. And to think I came here to stop drinking. My name is Charlie Parker. I'm an alcoholic.